Today, I'm excited to introduce Mattia Gabrillo, an interdisciplinary creative consultant, art director, designer, and researcher. Mattia's meticulous and eclectic approach has led him to work with an impressive roster of clients, including 21 Savage, Drake, Nike, and Meta. In this episode, we'll discuss Mattia's journey in design, his dedication to hormonal health, and his latest venture, Talc, a non-toxic luxury deodorant made with 100% grass-fed and finished beef tallow. Mattia, thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you for the warm introduction, and a bit pretentious of me to put the clients first, but nonetheless, it's nice to hear for sure.
Yeah. So let's talk about your upbringing. I love hearing about how people's upbringing impacts where they end up in life. Mm-hmm. So take mm-hmm. me back to young Mattia and everything in between then and now.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. I think that everybody has a particular like provenance story, and that kind of informs their later decision making and their careers and so forth. But as it pertains to the things we're discussing today, I think there was always this childlike inclination towards layout and design and things of that nature. I remember being 7 or 8 years old, and I think I've told this story to anybody that asks or that will listen, honestly. I would be like measuring letters equidistant from one another without having
hilarious.
Any formalized training.
Like when you were practicing writing?
We'd have like these little duotangs, if anyone remembers those, but with subjects and title pages and stuff like that. So for with each subject, as the seasons kind of change and the year goes on, you'd make a new title page. And I'd be doing the title pages with like, again, the equidistant letters and using grids and these kind of systems and small type without having any sort of thought as to what that meant. But that was kind of the beginning. And later throughout the course of my life, you kind of get caught up in the world of sports and girls and wanting to pursue business and playing sports at a high level. I was able to travel internationally consistently. So that kind of took center stage for me and became front of mind. And in that process, you kind of lose those latent inclinations and those desires from childhood. So I was able to rediscover that actually at some point, and the rest is kind of history, but I can go into more depth. I feel like let's start with a succinct answer, if you will.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think that when you're able to follow your innate childhood inclinations mm-hmm. toward different topics
yeah.
or interests, that's when you end up finding your most successful path oftentimes, because I feel like so many people go against the grain of what's actually natural to them. And then their whole life is kind of like an uphill battle as a result. So it's nice to hear that you're able to reconnect with what came naturally in childhood. What led you to reconnecting with that side of things?
Yeah, there was a particular moment in university. I went directly out of high school to one of the more renowned programs here in the country. And I had a chance to work with a group, and we were doing some sort of assignment. I think it was for economics or stats. I can't remember which course in particular, but we were assigned to make a logo for the group. And so me being kind of inclined towards those things, I downloaded like a cracked version of Adobe. Adobe, please don't sue me. I made like a logo for our group. And in that process, I was like, wow, there's something here. There was kind of a reawakening of that latent desire, so to speak. And Robert Greene kind of talks about this in Mastery, which I'd actually read after the fact. And if anybody's interested, that's a great read too. So yeah, it was just that moment of making something again and kind of feeling that connection to one's childhood. It's very impactful and kind of resonated with me and shifted my directionality and the path I was taking.
Something that comes to mind when I think of you is how you have this very specific taste and attention to detail within that taste, which is what makes you a great graphic designer and someone that I really trust when it comes to graphic design, because you do have that really refined style, but I feel like it translates into so many parts of your life. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, how did that come to be?
Even again, as a child, I would write very small. And if you look at layouts from Swiss designers, the Armin Hoffmans, the kind of the progenitors of today's style, Joseph Mueller-Brockman and so forth, grid systems, they have a very, very particular sensibility in the way they design. And I'm very much a minimalist in a lot of things I do. But now as I've kind of grown older, I've enjoyed more maximalism, but it needs to be very nuanced and tasteful in that sense. You'll notice that I don't really wear a lot of like loud clothing. I don't wear logos or marks or graphics. I mean, as somebody that designs them, it's kind of paradoxical that I would be capable of producing something that's so loud and out there for someone like a musical client. But I find that it's an exercise in reduction, and sophistication I find is often a little bit more minimalist. I think that's easier to execute a lot of the time, but there's a way to go about it. There's tasteful minimalism. There's nuanced minimalism. So I think that kind of permeates throughout my design language, and you obviously have an appreciation for it. So I appreciate that very much. And I'm just excited to keep pushing the boundaries and being more experimental and stepping out of my comfort zone, as any creative would like to.
Yeah, definitely. And then how do you feel like that attention to detail impacts the other aspects of your life?
This is another good question. I'm honestly borderline pedantic about things sometimes. Like, I'm weighing my food, you know?
This is what I'm thinking of. Yeah. I'm thinking of like your hormone guides, taste for food, even women.
Absolutely.
Like, the checklist.
Yeah, there's so many things. I think there's a certain rigidity that is required to be a good designer, I think, but then accepting that that rigidity can exist in a vacuum. It doesn't need to necessarily permeate through everything that one does. But at the same time, it does innately kind of end up being, you know, as a perfectionist, it does end up influencing your decisions and your tastes and your interests. So I think with my own personal life, I try to be very calculated and regimented and procedural. But there's definitely times when you just got to let that go and just enjoy the moment. I'm actually in one of those moments right now. I'm typically working out 7 days a week. And for the first time in like years, I don't even know, maybe 6 or 7 years, I'm taking like a full week off of the gym, not going for cardio, not going for weights, just allowing my body to kind of have that respite and to recover. And there was just an accumulation of fatigue. So just practicing those moments of considered carelessness, if you will, I think that's really important. And then as it pertains to like women, it's the same thing. I feel like everybody wants what they feel is the best and the best thing for them. I don't really see a point in sacrificing that. And maybe that's to a fault, but I guess I'll live with the results.
Yeah, I feel like it's all so valid. And I feel like I can be quite a perfectionist too. So I totally get where you're coming from. And I try to make those moments of, like you said, kind of calculated carelessness. Things like taking a break from my supplements once in a while. It's like, that's actually healthy.
Absolutely.
So tell me about a daily routine for you. I feel like you're very thoughtful in your in your use of time. And I feel like that's such a big topic. Like, people use their time so differently. So tell me what a day in the life looks like.
I don't really adhere to a particular schedule. I'm much more of like a task-oriented person. So completion of tasks and completion of daily deliverables, if you will. So that kind of starts with constantly waking up and getting sunlight, walking outside. I do a 15 or 16 minute walk every day. And just going through my neighborhood and kind of being one in with the environment, listening to podcasts, listening to science type material or whatever it may be. Sometimes it's sociological, sometimes it's political, sometimes it's biological, whatever it is that kind of informs me or starts the day off with some degree of learning. So I'll do that on my walk. Try to expose as much of my skin to the sunlight as possible. And that kind of, again, if you look at the science, that kind of anchors your circadian rhythm. And then from there, I like to go back. And the second thing I do after that, obviously brushing my teeth, doing the whole washing the face. But after the walk, we're going to go sit down and read a little bit. So I read every day, twice a day for the most part. Sometimes I miss an evening or something like that, or a morning if I'm behind. But for the most part, I'd say 95, 98% of the time, I'm reading twice a day. And I'm just reading a wide range of material. It's very eclectic. Things ranging from philosophy to psychology to economics to critical works of fiction by renowned authors. From there, again, this is going to be a long answer. But
From there,
it's back into deep work and making some coffee sometimes. I'm a bit of a coffee nerd, so I don't want to dive too much into the particulars of my pour over. But it's working. And then taking a break to go to the gym, audiobook at the gym for the duration of my mobility and warm up. And then listening to some music while I work out, and then back home eating and back to work. And then by the time, you know, it's later in the evening, let's say like 10 or 11, I try to get off. I used to go on to like 2 a.m. and I just realized I wasn't sleeping as well. So I try and limit my exposure to the computer and to screens overall, or at least not a large screen. And then I'll watch maybe a movie or a show nowadays. I've gotten back into shows and watching those because I do have aspirations to direct something one day. So I think it's kind of like a weird paradoxical way of like turning my brain off, but still absorbing things that could maybe influence my taste and my direction in the future.
Yeah, I totally know what you mean about turning your brain off at night. I feel like I used to be strict 9-to-5, like I would really have a schedule that way, and lately work lasts until like 11 p.m. sometimes, but I find that it takes me so long to wind down and fall asleep when I'm working that late. So need to get that back on track. But yeah, that makes sense. In terms of your reading, any great books lately?
Oh, yeah. I'm reading a really good, I mean, this is subjective, I think it's good, but I'm sure there's some other critical person out there who's going to say that the book I'm reading is terrible, but A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber.
Oh, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, it's the one I'm reading right now. And then I'm audiobooking a really good one. I think it's You Really Should Talk to Somebody by Lori Gottlieb.
Oh, yeah. I read that one a couple years ago.
Yeah. So I'm audiobooking that. And I just think that the narrator is doing a great job of this kind of conversational pacing and dialogue. And she does a really good job of speaking to the story in a compelling and interesting way. So I thought that was a great one. And I'm almost done. But those are the two at the moment. Great reads overall. There's so many. I mean, I try to read 52 books a year and I end up reading that, if not maybe a few more. It all becomes kind of like one massive compendium of knowledge. It's not really like one particular thing where I'm like, that book, that one, you know what I mean? Some of my favorite books, I said this in another podcast, Thomas Paine, Age of Reason. If you're interested in books from like the 1700s, it's not like a super dense book where you can't understand like Old English. It's relatively understandable, but it's an argument for deism and kind of how there are chronological inaccuracies in accounts from the Bible and so forth in Christianity. So it's a really interesting take on kind of the Age of Enlightenment for people back then. This is around the French Revolution and the founding of America. So that's an interesting one. One that comes to mind as well, that's one of my favorites of all time, would be The Denial of Death. I believe it's by Ernest Becker. That's a great book too. It talks about like how humans essentially are primary kind of sickness or illness. Freud would argue that it was this concern with sex, that he argues instead that it's our understanding that we're going to die. It's the knowledge that we have that no other animal has. So those are a few that come to mind. I'll read a book like Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls or whoever it was. And that's a great memoir about like growing up in a particular place through abject poverty. And honestly, like today would be considered child abuse, like how they were raised.
I know that one was wild. I read that one many years ago, but it's a good one too.
Yeah.
I find it's nice to absorb a wide range of reading. I feel like some people are always reading kind of about the same topic, which can be interesting too, because you're comparing all of these different authors' views on the same topic. But I find that people who are reading a more diverse range of literature tend to have more interesting ideas to bring to the table if you're hanging out. Okay, so let's get more into your design work. How do you feel like your design philosophy has changed over the years?
Well, when you're first starting, you're like a baby who's really just taking his first steps. You're simply emulating what you've kind of seen before, and you're trying to just match one-to-one maybe what you see in an adult human, if that's a good analogy. I don't know if it is. But the idea for me was that like, hey, you're incapable of having the taste because you're so nascent to the space. So you really got to put that time in to understand what's already been done. And so that one day you may do what already hasn't been done, if that makes sense. To be truly original, you have to have context or an understanding of what already exists. It was really an exercise in really developing that taste, being all consumed by it, almost monomaniacal with like an interest in design. And as you move along, things change. Obviously, you find things that you used to find interesting or well done to be a bit maybe banal or unoriginal, or you can kind of start to piece together things that are, I would say, either close approximations or works of people that are kind of epigones, if you will. It's not really anything that's special. It's more of a facsimile of somebody else's work. That's kind of how my philosophy has evolved over time. It's trying to exist within the context of what something is. So if you're making a magazine, what is a magazine? Obviously, it's a layout of things. But can you push that? Can you rotate it? Can you apply treatments, transparencies, and really being calculative with those decisions on the outer edges of what's considered a magazine in that case.
Yeah. And on that note, how do you stay inspired within this design world?
It's constantly looking at things, I think. You just have to constantly be forming an opinion on what's currently being put out, what's current in the culture, what's trending, and what's been done in the past, and reimagining those things. And I always harken back to this analogy of Polo Ralph Lauren and the iteration of the bomber jacket. It's this idea of we're not here to make an entirely new bomber jacket. There's probably been 200, 300 iterations of a bomber jacket or whatever figure that is, but we're trying to make the next iteration of the bomber jacket. I think that's a good way to look at it. But there's also a quote that kind of ruminates in my head, and I think it's good artists copy, great artists steal, and then I think the best of the best, they originate. You're the person that actually produces something that people steal. And those are exceedingly rare moments for one to be a part of. You know, it's not often that you have a truly original thought. And then the argument could be made, well, what is original anyways, right? Everything is in reference to one another. So it's an interesting space to be in because it's so subjective. That's
yeah.
What I'll say.
Yeah, definitely. And are there any specific resources you look to when you're trying to absorb different design to stay inspired? Or I guess not just design, but everything as a whole?
Yeah, magazines, websites, books, movies, literally anything. Like I'll see something on the street, maybe a piece of collateral or signage, and that'll kind of spur some inspiration. You take a photo of it and you kind of reverse engineer that on your own time. Or diagrams are also interesting to me. I think that there's something about diagrams. It's just this way of kind of communicating information in a visual format. It's very unique. But yeah, those are just the typical kind of standard ways. I just think some people have a knack for visualizing things and a degree of photographic memory in a sense. But for me, I have a pretty good grasp on what I've seen and what I've connected with in some way or capacity. But for the most part, just keeping up day to day, hours a day, It's no real special sauce or anything like that. There's just, it's consistency and never really taking a day off.
Yeah. And I feel like everything is so interconnected in terms of finding inspiration. I feel like I find inspiration for things in the places I least expect in terms of maybe I'm looking at some plating at a Japanese restaurant and it inspires a logo, like a suggestion of the general direction of a logo. So it's like, you never know where inspiration will come about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree. Inspiration kind of hits you in weird ways. And growing up, I always thought before I really became full-fledged in my creativity, I always thought, oh, what does that mean? Like, what hits you? But nowadays, you kind of know when it does. You're like, oh, there's a connection here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think like staying inspired is almost a skill in a way because it comes naturally. But also when it becomes your career, you need to be thoughtful about continuing to stay inspired and finding new avenues to stay inspired. Gearing out of design and into health, you're the king of hormone health. So what initially sparked your interest in the topic?
I think there's an almost kind of narcissistic or egotistical male thing here where it's like, you just want to have high testosterone, bro. You know what I mean? Like, as bad as that sounds, I think testosterone is kind of a signal of vitality and virility. If you can kind of maximize that, that's the thing that makes you a man for the most part, really. If you look at hormone profiles, it's not so much that men don't have estrogen, it's the presence of testosterone that really differentiates the sexes. So I was like, how do I become more of a man kind of thing? Jokes aside, I just think if you can live better, you always want to try to. Most people are like that. Like, you want to feel better, live better, do better. And I've always been somebody that's interested in optimizing my health and my well-being. So that was the natural evolution in that pursuit, was to kind of dive into whatever it is that I found. And I don't want to say it's like research per se, but it is research to a degree. When you're listening to people at the top of their field across disciplines, it does kind of become almost like an informal education, if you will. So compiling all that knowledge and showing people how I got results, some random person or distant friend maybe that's keeping in touch with me sees that, hey, this person I know did this. I can do this too. I think there's a kind of an inspiring thing about that in particular. It makes it much more relatable and digestible to hear it from somebody a bit closer to home, as opposed to maybe somebody who has 5 million subscribers and a huge podcast, right? Like, you're like, oh, this person could be grifting. They could have sponsorships. They could have whatever. For me, I try to glean it down to the practical applications.
Yeah, definitely. I think you have a good way of sharing it in a way that's digestible too. I feel like sometimes it gets so high level where I'm like, what is even going on here? Yeah, I feel like the guides that you have made have made it easily accessible to anyone who is maybe just starting to explore that particular aspect of their health or maybe their health in general. So how do you feel like hormonal health ties into overall well-being?
Again, I'm not a doctor, so no one listened to me. But if you were to listen to me in this case, which you are, I would say that it's pretty critical. There's a bunch of other things that are going on, obviously, neurochemically. And there's all these interactions that occur in the body. But hormone health is something that can really make or break somebody, right? If you have tanked hormones as a man or a woman, you find that you don't feel that great. You have issues with libido, erectile dysfunction for men, entire range of issues with women. You have like brittleness in bones as women go through menopause and stuff like that. So there's all these different things that occur in the body that are very much requiring of proper hormone health. If we're talking about an N of one or like an anecdotal thing for me specifically, I would say that when I didn't really optimize or pay attention to what I was eating to the degree that I am now, there was a bit more of like a fog, if you will, like a brain fog. Effort feels really, really good. I feel really good doing what I do. I love what I do on top of that. So maybe there's some sort of interaction there. It's amazing to be able to be driven in a way that most people can't really understand, because at the time of speaking, you know, I've gotten my blood tests and I've had levels in the 1220s for total testosterone. And that's considered exceptionally, exceptionally high. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm just saying that you really feel the effects of that when you're in the day-to-day and you're going through tasks and you're looking to tech, kind of achieve things. It really drives you forward. There's also a degree of personality and disposition that I have. I don't really experience a ton of negative emotion personally, so I'm kind of low in neuroticism. But some people do, right? Women typically are a bit higher in that trait. I think it's just like a fine tuning and understanding yourself and what your baseline is to compare what optimal would look like for you.
Talk to me about how food plays a role in this. What are you thinking about when it comes to eating?
Food is so contentious because people have so many nutritional protocols that they swear by, but I think you really just got to find what's for you. And like, there are certain things that are pretty obvious in regards to overall health. You can make the argument carnivore, you can make the argument vegan, you can make the argument paleo, ketogenic, high fat, low fat, whatever it is. People will go across the entire spectrum, but things like pesticides, that's pretty obvious. Everybody wants to be one of them. Or forever chemicals like atrazine that's banned in the EU, stuff like that. I think that we all want to be conscious of. And even with organic, what does organic mean? Does that mean they use pesticides or not pesticides or certain types of pesticides? So doing your due diligence. I would also say that I make a considered effort, especially nowadays, to kind of optimize trace minerals, because people don't really pay attention to a lot of those. And there are things like copper toxicity, inadequate zinc, inadequate selenium that you don't really get nowadays from the way that we produce our monoculture crops. And I had read a book by Will Harris, A Bold Return to Giving a Damn. And he talks about White Oak Pastures, which is his family farm, and how they were able to kind of revitalize this patch of land. And they have completely almost circular agriculture. It's not like this industrialized monoculture growing of a single crop. All of the animal, first they're killed humanely, and then all the animal is then sequestered back into the lands. They're carbon negative in their output. So things like that are really interesting on like a moral or an ethical level.
But yeah. And how did you learn about that farm?
White Oak Pastures.
Okay.
I think I had heard like a clip from Joe Rogan or something, like some guy with a southern drawl. Yeah. I was listening to him. I was like, oh, this guy has some interesting things. And I was like, I don't know anything about farming. We're so removed nowadays. The vast majority of us and the populace, we don't have anything to do with that. Whereas historically, everybody was really just focused on food and sustenance. So we live in a time where we're able to kind of focus on what we're doing, these very abstract things in art. But at the same time, we've kind of lost our way. And a historian, Victor Davis Hanson, he talks about how people were educated in a fashion that we are no longer, and that some of our forefathers and grandparents could put their finger up in the air and know which direction the wind was growing. And they'd keep an almanac of what the temperature was going to be like for that day of that month of that year, based on the 7 previous years. There's a wisdom that's been kind of lost through this mechanical or physical labor, this muscular labor, as he calls it. And I think that for me, my father being part of the muscular class, being a contractor, being a painter, that was always close to home. And I didn't ever want to forget that, even being in a space like this where everything is, again, so subjective and abstract. So there's this weird kind of dichotomy in my personality between the idea of tradition and the idea of pushing things forward and trying to really, really expand on what is conventional.
Mm-hmm. And I think finding the balance between those is so important as well, because I feel like so many people are in terms of their focus. So, okay, building off of the what to focus on in terms of eating, what are your overall top 5 tips for hormonal health as it applies to both men and women?
Men is a bit easier because I'm obviously a man and I have a bit of a bias because I have a guinea pig, if you will, to test these things on, but no alcohol. I don't drink. So if you know me, you know you've tried to give me a drink before and I probably said no. I'll drink on a rare occasion, maybe a couple of times a year at most. Birthdays, I guess, is the last time I drank, which was in October of last year. Alcohol is definitely, there's no real benefits to that other than maybe the social benefits you glean from having kind of that lubricant and interacting with other people. Vaping, smoking cigarettes, pretty obvious. There's some studies to show that vaping actually reduces penis size, probably constricts blood flow to that region of the body. So if you're concerned about that, like you should be, then you definitely don't want to vape or smoke. If you're going to use nicotine for stimulant effects and perhaps creating things or some professors swear by it, you could probably find those Zyn bag things that people use and dose that accordingly. I mean, I don't know too much about that particular field. Trying to eat adequate amount of fat is very important for hormone production. As a man, I try to get 35 to 40% of my calories from fat sources that are good. So things that are rich in omega-3s, you get a lot of omega-6s pretty easily in our Western diet here in the US and Canada. So there's that. Protein consumption is pretty important too. Protein is essential, to the production of other neurotransmitters like tryptophan and serotonin. So it's downstream from that. So you should be getting enough of that. The science, again, is just like bro science, like 1 gram per pound. There seems to be pretty strong evidence that it's 1.6 grams per kilogram is kind of the upper threshold of what's viable for someone. I tend to go to like the 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram or like 0.82 grams per pound to 1 gram per pound range. Some people just enjoy protein. You know what I mean? Like I'm not going to not tell somebody to eat too much protein. If like you really enjoy it, it sits well, you don't have any GI distress, like why not just eat more if that's your thing? But just know that there's probably diminishing returns. So protein, fats, and then carbs seem to be the one that you can kind of just modulate based on your activity level. I think that for me, I tend to do a little bit better on fruits, honey, stuff like that, but I'll have some sourdough and occasionally I'll have a pasta every once in a blue moon. But I find that I don't feel as good unless I'm eating those kinds of meats and fish and eggs and stuff like that.
I mean, I feel like protein is so buzzy right now. Like for so long, it was like vegan, vegan, vegan.
Yeah.
And now everyone's like, yeah, I'm eating those chomp sticks. Have you heard of those?
Yeah. Meat sticks. They're packed with protein. She had a little stint where I was in LA And I was eating like four of those a day. Like,
oh, I was just talking to my friend yesterday. I was FaceTiming her. She was in the bath. And she's like, I have three Chompsticks with me. I'm eating them all right now. I was like, wow, people are really going heavy in the protein now. But I mean, I feel personally way better having a protein-rich diet. So
absolutely. It's amazing. Yeah.
What inspired you to create Talg? Did this come from your research in hormone health?
Yeah, Talg is a venture that we started because my partner Austin and I were kind of just talking about things, as two gentlemen do through the Instagram DMs, about just deodorant and wanting to kind of produce a product. And he was talking about beef tallow and beef tallow balm. And he kind of originates his family to a degree from Texas. And there's kind of a rural pastoral culture, if that's even a word, where they're kind of interested in things that are pertaining to living off the land. And beef tallow is part of no-sit-tail eating, where you try and use all the animal. There seemed to be good understanding and support for the science of beef tallow. And then you combine that with the trending nature of that particular topic on things like TikTok. It was kind of a no-brainer for us to combine those two things and create a beef tallow-based hormone safe deodorant. And that was the impetus for Talg, is we wanted to create something that didn't exist, whether it was having a particular design language that was really contemporary and high-end and almost high fashion, but also very approachable, hormone safe again with the formula, transparency across the board, including all fragrance ingredients, having low EWG scores. We're using algae-based ink, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So for the packaging of the product itself and the outer packaging?
We have our primary vessel. And initially, we're going to do a refillable system. It was going to be a cast aluminum vessel with a silicone insert. And that way, there was no plastic contacts. That being said, that was kind of cost prohibitive without any proven market fit. So we decided to kind of test our assumptions and produce something that was minimally viable. And that's the essential product that we're releasing in short order here. At the time of recording, it's probably only a few weeks away. The essential package is a biodegradable FSC certified paper exterior. And then we use a medical or food grade PP plastic for the interior twist. And then the printing of that, so all the ink on that, is actually based out of algae. We partnered with the firm in the States, and they do that, and they have distribution channels throughout the world. So we're using algae ink, actually, which is actually also carbon negative.
Yeah, that's so cool. I'm going to have to connect with you more about the algae ink
we'll
later. Let's talk algae ink. Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me more about, I feel like I've heard personally about beef tallow as a moisturizer a lot, and how it has benefits using it as a moisturizer, a chapstick, that sort of thing. But tell me about how it works as a deodorant.
Yeah, so beef tallow shares a very similar lipid profile to that of our skin. So there's kind of a natural harmony in application there. And the underarm region for some people can be quite sensitive. So moisturizing it, there's a lot of benefit. In addition to that, we're actually seeking a certification firm out in Europe. I think it's Norway or Sweden, called Kindabiome. And because of our formula is actually water-free, there's no preservatives in it. So we're actually a really good candidate for that certification. And that was also an additional benefit of using beef tallow as our kind of primary fat, if you will.
Okay, amazing. I know through working on products for clients that the process is so intensive from start to finish. So what did that process look like?
Well, if anybody was listening and the overly pedantic part of my personality came out, it was no different here. Like, working with Austin and some of our previous partners who decided to part ways, I feel like I've slowed down the project a lot, just with trying to really push again. And there's that aspect of not wanting to let go of something that's your baby until you feel like it's ready. That process has been an exercise of restraint to a degree, and just kind of realizing, okay, it's not going to be perfect. We need to put something out there for people to resonate with and to start trying out and to assess whether or not they're interested in purchasing long term. But yeah, I mean, just being as stringent as possible with things that really, really matter. So like the formula, for example, and the fragrance profiles, doing the whole back and forth with the fragrance houses, making sure that we tried the natural fragrance route, didn't like it, didn't feel good, didn't feel the benefits of going for natural fragrance. So we're using exclusively low EWG score and non-endocrine disrupting essential oils. You won't find anything like lavender in there, which conventionally people think, oh, lavender is good. If you look at lavender, it's actually extremely estrogenic. So if you have any lavender products in your home, you don't want to actually be using that. So I would say throw those away. And you can look at the science and it supports that.
I take baths in lavender.
Yeah, so lavender is really not good for you. Okay, and the same with soy.
Heard about soy. Okay.
Yeah, but if you ferment it, for example, the estrogen load is greatly, greatly diminished. We're talking like hundreds of times lower. So it's like, I think it was something like 245,000 micrograms per 100 grams or something like that for soy beans. And then soy sauce is like 2. Ridiculously low figure. Yeah. So if people are interested, fermenting can remove a lot of those negative characteristics of an ingredient.
What are the initial scents that you're launching with?
We have two unisex scents. One of them is a bit more masculine leaning and one of them is more feminine leaning. For me, I personally prefer the feminine one, which is kind of funny, but I guess that's my personality. We have Juniper and Palo Santo, the masculine one, and then Vanilla Santal, which is the more feminine one. Yeah.
Okay, nice. I'm so excited to try.
Yeah, I'm excited to get it to you. We'll get you a sample.
Yes, and it's launching in a few weeks.
Hopefully in a few weeks, yeah. Okay. We're going to start collecting pre-orders and stuff like that and seeing what kind of traction we can gather.
Okay, exciting. Are you planning to get store placements or will it be strictly e-com?
Yeah, we want to do specific retail channels and establish those partnerships because I think that it's important to have a brick and mortar presence. People want to see something that they haven't maybe seen for the first time in person as opposed to through a screen. So that's really important. I know that a long-term goal of mine would definitely be Erewhon, and we have some relationships with people that have been able to get in there, and Whole Foods would be great too. That'd be a large account that we'd love to be a part of. So if anybody's listening at any of those places, please email us.
Yes.
Essence, I think the typical spots that are like more organic focused.
Yeah.
It is a luxury product, but it's consumable and it's approachable for most people.
Yeah. And I feel that. I mean, the luxury wellness space is doing so well right now. So you're in at a perfect time. I feel like people are really, and people are really willing to put money into their health these days.
Absolutely.
Tell me how you're balancing all of this, your design work, your product.
Yeah.
And I mean, your health takes up quite a bit of time too. So what does that balance look like? I know you told me about your actual schedule, but in terms of more like the overarching balance of your life, how does that look?
Habit stacking.
Yes.
So James Clear talks about this in Atomic Habits. Habit stacking. So like when I'm working out, for example, I do 45 minutes or so mobility. The goal is to be able to be 65 with my grandchildren going on hikes and doing things. I want to kind of forecast for that future. Who knows as to what the efficacy of these measures are, but for me, it's like, might as well just do it. I'm reading a book and listening to an audiobook while I'm doing that. So like, it's really no loss to me. On top of doing that, putting it at 1.5x speed, you know what I mean? These little things that are just these incremental changes that add up over time. There's that. I would also say that this year in particular, just with the economics, it's been really slow, but it's been kind of a weird blessing in disguise because I've been able to put more time into the business, right? So that's one thing that's been super helpful.
Yeah, those things I find do come as a blessing in disguise because when things get busy, it's like you're client-centric at all times. And then you need those moments of breathers to actually focus on your own business development. And especially with you developing a new product, I'm sure that it's coming at an especially good time.
Yeah, I mean, hearing you talk about 8 meetings in a day, it's just like you're back to back to back of 8 hours. That's a designer or a creative's kind of worst nightmare in some ways. If they're meeting for like workshopping, maybe, but it's all like, here's an analogy that I'll make. And this might make sense to some people, might not to some. For those that make music, there's the process of making music. So I've had a chance to sit in rooms with artists like Boslin and see him in his process and other people and other artists in so many places in LA and Vancouver. Again, there's that process of creating, and there's so much joy and time flies and there's this kind of weird ethereal kind of levity to that process. But then there's the mixing and the mastering and the coloring of all the channel. And that's no fun. I look at the meetings as kind of almost like this mixing and mastering of the music. And you really want to be doing the majority in the music. You know what I mean? They're spending the majority of your time in that music, in that creation of the music, as opposed to the fine details. But presentation also is everything in design, right? So it's kind of part and parcel, right? There's that saying.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think that all people kind of fit together as a puzzle. And I mean, especially I think about that within my own agency. It's like we all have our different ways we want to spend our time and our own interests. For me, the relationship component is the most exciting and fulfilling to me. So I actually don't mind a day full of meetings because I just get to chat with so many business owners, hear about what's on their mind, what's been challenging, what's working for them, and take all of those insights home with me. Whereas sitting and being creative actually makes me feel drained in a way. Like it's something that I have to kind of force more. Whereas like, I feel like you or Devin are more the opposite. So I feel like everyone kind of like works together in that way.
Yeah. I mean, you know me, like I'm super social. Like I love going out constantly with a bunch. I have tons and tons of friends and I'm so grateful for that. I just find that during the week when you need time to really just get into the deep work, meetings can be kind of a distraction to that. It's not that I don't enjoy it. I just think that those can be antithetical processes to one another. The process of talking to people and discussing logistics and operations and the process of creating and actually doing and executing. So it's an interesting balance that one has to walk, but I think that we all have our way of going about it. And I'm really happy to hear that you enjoy the meetings. Like I definitely enjoy some and I don't enjoy others.
I think we all have those ones that we don't enjoy. What is one lesson that you've learned thus far in your career that you wish you learned earlier with the hope of maybe helping someone avoid learning it the hard way?
Oh, when you're young and when you're first getting started, you have almost this weird thinking or this idea that it's going to be pretty easy for some reason. You think like, oh, it's like, I don't know what these people are talking about. It's not going to be that hard. But the amount of rejection, the amount of things that are out of your control, and just the sheer amount of disappointment you will encounter is really difficult for me to like overstate this. Because really, you do feel the effects of it as you go through your career as somebody who's entrepreneurial or self-employed or a freelancer. You have to have that fortitude. So I would say be prepared and don't beat yourself up about things. So many things are outside of your control. You could send an email to somebody and be a perfect candidate for a role or an opportunity or a proposal. And they could be going through something in their own personal lives that maybe they glanced at it in the car and they forget. So don't take it personally. Look at it as kind of character building, and you're on a hero's journey, if you will. You know what I mean? You can't really enjoy the good if you don't know what the bad was before. I would say that. And I use that to kind of drive me in moments of doubt. And you'll lay there at night thinking like, oh man, I'm not where I want to be. And I think everybody feels that to a certain degree when you're in this space and you're competitive and you want to be considered among the best. But you have to remember that you're also in a subjective industry too. There's no objective measure as to who's the best. So why are you even kind of thinking of that? It's this weird paradox of the mind. It's comparison is the thief of joy, I believe is the saying. So that's what I would say. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like being as prepared as you can for those challenging moments that will inevitably come your way is for the better, because when you get into this mindset of everything's going to be easy, it hits you harder when it's hard, as opposed to recognizing that things do get hard, and then you can kind of bounce back from it pretty quickly when you have that mindset of knowing like, oh, there's going to be challenges and bumps along the way all the time.
Absolutely. And one addition to that I'll say is that everything takes a lot longer than people think.
Yeah. Well, I know that from talking to so many new businesses, and it's always like our initial meeting, we're launching in 1 month, and then 1 year down the line, they haven't launched yet. And it's kind of the continual iterations and everything just takes longer. Cause I think that people set these timelines thinking of how quickly am I going to do my action points, but not considering that there's so many other people involved that need to do their side of things too. Like, how quickly am I going to choose a fragrance once the options are sent to me, but you're not considering how long are they going to take on their side to do their part of the puzzle. I feel like that's what's like forgotten in these timelines.
Totally true. And now having kind of the experience and the know-how and the insight as to what happens conducting a startup or conducting business as a startup, if you will, there are so many delays that are out of your control. You know, shipping, holidays in different countries, time zones, you know what I mean? I'm up sometimes at 3-4 in the morning speaking to manufacturers or vendors in Asia or London. There's just so many moving parts that need to be considered, or 3PL. And, you know, do they have warehouses in this particular state or that state? I would just say that things take a lot of time. Be patient with yourself. Give yourself more time than you really think. And that way you kind of prepare for the worst in some capacity. And that's kind of a stoic principle or a thinking where you negatively visualize. And that way, when you head into that, you're not taken aback or shocked by something not going your way or panning out correctly.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely.
I feel like there is so much different value between health and design and everything in between. So where can everyone find you?
Yeah, you can go to my website at m-gab.work.com, or you can go to our studio, mandatoryattendance.com, and you can go check out Talg at talgh.co. So talg.co if you're interested. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, cheers.